you've read about poetry recently, it's probably because someone was asking whether it was dead. Hardly a year goes by without someone, sometimes some of our best poets, debating whether poetry can still be relevant in the 21st century. Poet Ben Lerner's recent book about poetry was distinctive for not asking whether poetry was dead, but it was still titled Hatred of Poetry. In his new book, How to Play a Poem, Don Bielostoski offers a new way of reading poetry that tries to help readers appreciate poems in new ways. This approach to poems is based on readers being active in creating meaning, rather than thinking that they have to slavishly understand what a teacher or a poet is telling them. It involves identifying points of connection with poems before examining how they are new or strange, and it shows readers how to connect with poems and get pleasure out of reading them, rather than being intimidated by them or turned off by unimaginative teaching. I'm Dan Kubis, host of the University of Pittsburgh's Being Human podcast, and I recently spoke with Don about his new book and about the new way of approaching poems it offers readers. Don Bielostoski, thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you, Dan, for having a chat with me.
Sure. So we're going to talk about your new book that's coming out with the University of Pittsburgh Press, and it's called How to Play a Poem.
Yes.
In the introduction to How to Play a Poem, one of the things you say is that there are a lot of books about reading poetry and appreciating poetry already, but there are two things that you're doing in this book that you think that are new.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is right in the title.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you talk about playing a poem rather than reading it. So
yes.
Maybe we can start by talking a little bit about the importance of playing a poem for you.
Well, I think a lot of what we do with poems in our sort of standard approaches involves taking them apart, using them as examples of things, pressing through them to some other meaning. My idea of playing is that a poem is in many ways like a musical score or like a dramatic script, and requires, because it's dead words on the page until someone brings it to life, requires a reanimating act on the part of the reader, in the imagination at the very least, in oral performance sometimes, but in the imagination to really try to hear how that script would be performed, what the tones would be as the utterance moved forward. We don't typically think of poetic texts that way, although we think of dramatic texts that way.
That it needs someone to participate with it, in other words.
It needs someone to participate with it. It needs someone to bring it back to life.
Yeah. Well, that actually brings me to what is the second thing that is new, that it's kind of differentiates your How to Play a Poem from some of the other books that are out there about how to read poetry and appreciate poetry, which is a new definition of what a poem is, right? And that definition is that poems are utterances designed and packaged for pleasurable reanimation.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about what that definition means.
Well, the first thing I think utterance says that the poem is waiting to be or enacted. It belongs still in the domain of our speaking, but it's kind of freeze-dried on the page. But you can't just add water. it's better than that. It's better than freeze-dried because it's actually been organized by somebody who's offering it up and says, here's a good one to do something with. When you see a poem, you anticipate that the person who made it, in most cases at least, made it with the hope that somebody else was going to pick it up and try to make it out, make something of it. And what I think has to be made is a reanimation. And I think that act of reanimating the poet anticipates is going to be something enjoyable, although not always enjoyable in the kind of easy, saccharine enjoyable sense. I mean, when you pick up a musical score to play it, some of them are kind of easy, some of them are harder, some of them you can do without a lot of musical training, some of them you need a lot of training and a lot of practice to make them out. But there are special pleasure in the hard ones as well as in the easy ones.
Yeah. That reminds me of one of the other things that I really appreciated about your book, which was that you talk about one of the ways that people have approached poems in the past is by talking about poems as being ways to encounter words in new settings, new ways. Mm-hmm. And a fancy word to describe that in some cases is defamiliarization.
Yes. Right?
And one of the things you say about this is that we need to focus on what seems familiar before we can focus on what seems unfamiliar in poems. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of focusing on familiarity in poems?
Well, I'll just say I think that a lot of the teaching of poetry goes straight to the unfamiliar. It goes straight to Tropes and Figures, asking students to identify what's unusual here and often to classify what's unusual here, often to go through and expect it to be representing some kind of symbolic significance beyond what's on the face of it. The approach that I'm taking is really one inspired by the Russian theorists I've been interested in, Mikhail Bakhtin and Valentin Voloshinov, that says artistic discourse is based on, grows from, and depends upon the everyday language that we use. And it does something interesting with it, and so you can expect it always to turn in some way. But if you don't have the ordinary expectation of what it was before it turned, you don't really recognize the turn as a turn. You don't recognize the change as a change. And so my mantra in the book is familiarize before you defamiliarize. And I guess the key kind of familiarizing I call attention to is to pay attention to what Bakhtin, my inspiration, calls speech genres, which is to say, the kinds of utterances that we use in our everyday exchanges with each other, confession, apology, complaint, brief anecdote, hundreds of others, that are the sort of starting places for what much of the poetry that we read depends upon and transforms in curious and interesting ways.
That seems like one of the reasons why this book could not only be something that general readers would enjoy, but that teachers in particular would enjoy. That seems like a really great way to approach trying to teach poetry to students.
Well, it grows out of my own teaching. I've been teaching Introduction to Critical Reading or Introduction to Poetry for many, many years in my career. And when I came upon the works of these theorists that I was interested in, I was asking myself, what implications might they have if we were going to try to actually enact a teaching practice that grew from them? And I start my classes actually with some thinking about everyday discourse types, and then move from there to a series of increasingly complicated poems, starting with very simple and straightforward ones to very elaborate ones that often involve a series of or interrelations between those simple speech genres, but still engage them.
Yeah.
And I do think that it's been a successful teaching practice for me, and the book in a way is a kind of narrative of the steps in teaching that I think other teachers could adopt, and that people who are just trying to learn to read for themselves could also follow in learning to do this.
Yeah. Well, you talk about a lot of one of the things that you do in the book is you talk about a lot of poetic devices and things they contribute to mm-hmm. and enjoy. They can contribute to an mm-hmm. enjoyable reading of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
One of the devices that holds a special place for you is tone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you write in the book that tone is the life itself that we want to recreate from all those other devices. Mm-hmm. What is tone for you, and why does it play such an important role?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is it's not a device. I think it's often listed right. among the devices. It's one of the things that when students are called upon to talk about a poem, they're sort of identify the tone to, identify the metaphors. I think tone is the movement of the voice that we need to recreate from the various textual signs that the poet has offered to us. It's usually not a single sound or single. So it's really the sound that projects the moving evaluation of the speaker's utterance in relation to what he's talking about or what mm-hmm. she's talking about, mm-hmm. to whom the speaker is speaking, mm-hmm. Whom the speaker is responding to in making the utterance. Our tones reflect our attitudes and valuations of all of them, and often utterances are quite dynamic in their movement among both toward whom the tone is being directed and also what kind of tone is moving. Because one of the things that happens in poems is that tones change.
Yeah. It seems very hard to name in that sense.
Well, because it's the big thing.
Yeah.
Because it's the thing that when you put a text on the page isn't there any longer. It's here as you and I are talking to one another, but if there were a transcript of this conversation, even the emphasis that I'm placing on what I'm saying, the question marks at the end of your queries, all of those would have to be marked in some way,
yeah.
or reconstructed by somebody who was reading.
Right. Well, one of the other things that you talk about in the book is verse. I really liked what you had to say about verse in the book, and that is the kind of arrangement of language into mm-hmm. rhythm and meter and things mm-hmm. like that. You write that verse enables an enlivening freedom for the reader, not in spite of the constraints it imposes, but because of them.
Mm-hmm. Right?
How do the constraints that verse introduces into language allow a reader some more freedom?
Well, I mean, I think that's not what many people think, especially about accentual syllabic verse, that is verse really written in the standard metrical patterns, which is the verse I talk most about.
Sure. You just something you have to learn. It's kind of the boring part for a lot of people.
And you think, I mean, the things kids will tell you is it's sing-song.
Yeah.
But actually, the pattern, the expected pattern, like a speech genre, is a ground against which figure can appear, if you will. It's a starting, it's a set of regular expectations that allows you to identify irregularities. It also governs a routine set of emphases, so you can tell where the weight falls. I'll give a very, very quick, simple example, but one that I think makes a difference. And iambic pentameter, da 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 da, that sounds pretty sing song. It's the meter of Shakespeare's sonnets, and if you are just reading the first line, I don't remember the number of this sonnet, but it's one that I've used a few times. It's people will read it. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love that alters when it alteration finds.
Mm-hmm.
But if you follow out the iambic tread of those lines and actually attend to it, let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love that alters when it alteration finds. That the first line sounds all different, like I'm not going to be the one to do it.
Right.
Whereas read off in that kind of more prosaic way, you miss that weight altogether, and the weight falls on the not, on the negation, but not on the person.
Yeah.
That's one way it guides your recognition of emphasis. But how much weight you put on things is open to you, and there are many, many places where the meter isn't certain, or where there are choices left about how much weight to put down in relation to the basic pattern mm-hmm. That enables a greater freedom than you might think. But it's a freedom against the background of expectation.
Yeah.
Because a lot of what I'm interested in is that you've got to have some expectations before you can have any kind of movement in relation to expectations.
Yeah, I was thinking about this along the same lines we were talking earlier about introducing things that are familiar mm-hmm. in a poem. Before you can figure out what's new about a poem, you need to figure out what it's doing that's familiar.
Right, and of course, versification isn't exactly familiar. It's artificial.
Right.
But it's an artificial constraint that provides a framework of expectation. I mean, it was in a way the only, I love this, I got this from James McCauley, it was in a way the only recording technology for the recreation of voice until Edison, mm-hmm. right? The structuring of that language on the page was guiding you on where to put the emphasis, was varying sometimes so that you couldn't stay with the meter and had to change it and therefore had to notice something you wouldn't otherwise have noticed. That technology, once other recording technologies have come in, I think have enabled free verse to kind of loosen up the possibilities. But even there, the line still provides some structuring expectations that are important.
Yeah. Well, in How to Play a Poem, the appendix of the book is where you talk a little bit about the scholarly context and the history of your book.
Yes.
And there you also talk about your own history as a reader and a writer of a reader of poetry and a writer about poetry.
Mm-hmm.
You describe your engagement with poetry as beginning with your engagement with William Wordsworth's mm-hmm. poetry and how your career in mm-hmm. English is in large part based on that. Mm-hmm. What is it about Wordsworth's poems mm-hmm. that has meant so much to you?
Well, I have to say, I started out being interested in Wordsworth's prose.
Okay.
and I wrote a dissertation about his well-known preface to lyrical ballads, which supposedly precedes a collection of poems. And then I was hired to be a a scholar who both taught the poems and taught the prose. And I realized that reading the prose had not really helped me figure out how to read the poems. And so I set out to try to figure out how to read them. And I guess that's really what eventually has led me to this pass, because thinking with Mikhail Bakhtin was actually enormously helpful in sorting that out. I think, though, that what's special about Wordsworth, and he figures more than any other poet in the book, partly because I know him better than any other poet, but also because he was deliberately departing from a set of routinized expectations in poetry and was trying to really train his readers to think about their experience of reading in new ways. He was writing narrative poems in particular, and I talk about him most when I'm writing about narrative poetry in the book. He was writing narrative poems that were deliberately designed to disappoint expectations about narrative and to force readers to try to figure out what else was going on in a poem, or poems that were very subtly varying, say, the distance between the speaker and the subject of the poem. His experiments, and that's what he called them in the preface to Lyrical Ballads, were really teaching experiments, experiments in altering and therefore calling attention to expectations that had been kind of flattened out by the sort of standardized verse that he started out writing, and that was the kind of verse that had been regular in the period before him. Subtler than he gives it credit for being, I have to say. I have some nice things to say about Alexander Pope along the way.
Sure.
But still,
you always have to define your enemies in a certain way before you, or those who came before you, before you go on.
Yeah, your opponents are always getting a little bit underplayed.
Yeah.
As are mine, I suppose. I mean, my new critical opponents, I think, probably are not always getting the fullest account of the possibilities of what they have to say, but the routinized practices that emerged from their work that I think shape a whole array of our usual questions when teaching poetry are what I set myself to try to revise.
Yeah. Well, the appendix of your book here is also where you talk about your goals and your hopes for how to play a poem.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes beyond for you. I mean, I think all people who write books hope they sell a lot and a lot of people read them, and you want that to happen too.
Mm-hmm.
But there you have some broader goals and hopes for how to play a poem can do once once it's published. What do you hope it does?
Oh, I think they're exaggerated hopes. You have to get to the very end of the book to read them. Speaking about the new critics, I suppose my biggest hope is that my book would at least come to stand on the shelf next to Cleanth Brooks's book, The Well-Wrought Urn, which was the book, I think, like mine, written for a wider audience than just scholars, that had a large influence in shaping the new critical approaches that continue to be commonplace in the way we teach poetry. I'd like my book to sit next to it. In my wildest dreams, I'd like to see that book kind of begin to tip off the shelf while mine sat there, but that's a hyperbolic hope. I guess I also see the book as, and this reflects a piece of my own career. I was a student of Wayne Booth's at the University of Chicago, and I think Wayne Booth's Rhetoric of Fiction was a book that reached a much wider audience than just a scholarly audience in shaping attitudes toward fiction. And I would love to see my book be a kind of late Chicago school contribution that does the same thing for thinking about lyric poetry.
Well, I will say, Don, one of the things for me when I read it that came through most was your own enthusiasm and excitement for the poetry that you were reading and talking about. That was really evident on the page, and I hope that a lot of other people, I think that a lot of other people who read it will probably get the same enthusiasm and excitement just as I did.
Well, I think that the work of reanimating poems, the play. I mean, funny those two words go together, but I mean, it's work to learn to play a piece of music too. The work and play of reanimating poetry takes a poem as an opportunity to have some fun along the lines that somebody has scripted for you. One of the words that I got from Valentin Voloshinov was co-creation, which I think is a really useful word. That's the job of the reader, to co-create, and that's both creative, but the prefix indicates that you're creating something that somebody else has made, and so you have to honor and attend to the markings, as it were. One of the things I hope that this book does is provide the kind of guidance to identifying a number of the markings that poets offer, from versification to gestures, to choices of words that are there to guide your reanimation, the way time signatures and marks of emphasis are there in a musical score to guide your playing of a piece or your singing of a piece as well.
Yeah. Well, it definitely reminded me, among other things, of how much fun reading poetry can be. So.
Well, I hope a lot of people will have more fun if they have a chance to read it and go back to reading poems with it.
I hope they will too. Don, thanks so much for joining us.
Dan, thank you for giving me a chance to talk with you.
Sure. Don Bielostoski is professor and chair of English at the University of Pittsburgh. His new book, How to Play a Poem, will be published by the University of Pittsburgh Press in May 2017.